Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're gonna cry, 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 and you cry alone. When everyone's forgotten and you're left on your own, you're gonna cry, cry, cry.
Grab a box of tissues. This could get emotional. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, the science behind the pain and pleasure of music-induced weeping. Plus a live performance from the Philadelphia rock band, The War on Drugs. But to begin, in an age of never-ending upbeat pop and hip-hop anthems, it might sound strange, but about half the general population actually enjoys listening to sad music, even if it makes them cry. In a moment, we'll meet a writer who's part of that group, and we'll ask you, our listeners, to share the songs that make you misty-eyed. But first, joining me on the phone is David Huron. He's head of Ohio State University's Cognitive and Systematic Musicology Lab. He's on the line from California, where he's doing some research. David, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me, John.
So half the population actually likes listening to sad music. Why would that be?
Well, aren't they crazy? It certainly is a paradox that so many people would like sad music. And because normally sadness is a negative, what we call a negatively valenced emotion, mm-hmm. and people try everything in their power usually to avoid negative emotions. So it has indeed been the case that we've been following up this as a topic of research and trying to figure out precisely the answer to your question. And there's lots to say there, but it looks like some unique physiology and personality plays a role.
This wouldn't be like something we evolved to do. I would expect from your first answer that it's quite the opposite. I mean, wouldn't we sort of be evolutionarily wired to not go for those negatively valenced emotions?
Well, there are different theories about this, but one of them has to do with contrast. There's the old joke or saw about why do you keep beating your head against the wall? And neuroscience actually lends some credibility to the answer because it feels so good when I stop. So the contrast here, especially when you experience sort of pseudo-sadness, a sad state where there's actually no reason to feel sad, you can feel pretty good through that whole experience. So the contrast makes a big effect here.
Now, earlier on our show, we talked about music that gives us chills, and you can find that, listeners, on our archives at wnyc.org/soundcheck. The idea that we have a kind of physical response to certain types of music. Is there something similar going on here when people are listening to and really having an emotional reaction to sad music?
Absolutely. The physiological aspects, in the case of chills, where you get goosebumps and the hair stands up on the back of your neck, that's very much a physiological response, which has a beautiful, there's a wonderful explanation for that. But on the other hand, you can also experience what we call breath holding, where people colloquially they say, "Oh, the music takes my breath away."
Right.
And literally, what they're doing is they're holding their breath. And in the case of crying, of course, you have the tears, you have the constriction in your throat, and so on. That's very much a physiological response. In fact, if you went to your family physician and you described your symptoms, you said, "Doctor, what's wrong with me? I have watery eyes, I have this nasal congestion, this constriction in my throat," your doctor would say, "Well, you're suffering from a systemic allergic response." So actually, crying looks for all the world like an allergy. So in each of these cases, in the frisson where you have the chills sort of running up and down your spine with hair standing up on the back of your neck, in the case of awe when you actually stop breathing momentarily, and in the case of crying where you look like you have an allergy, there's a very deep evolutionary and physiological reason why these specific kinds of responses occur.
Wow. We're speaking with David Huron. He's author of Sweet Anticipation, Music and the Psychology of Expectation. Let's sort of define our terms here, David. Sadness does not necessarily equal grief, right? There are two different...
Yeah, that's very true, and it's an important distinction. We commonly tend to think of them as the same thing, but actually... Sadness is involved with what we call low physiological arousal. So when you're sad, you slump, you have slumped posture, you tend to be quiet, maybe lose your appetite. Grief, on the other hand, this is a high arousal emotion. Your heart is pounding. You tend to wail or cry. All of those sorts of things. So, when we're in a state of mourning, if you know your favorite pet dies or something like that, typically what happens is a person will alternate between these two states: a state of active high arousal grief, where they're crying, and a state where there's low arousal sadness, where they're kind of ruminating and they're quite quiet.
Now, there's a song by Chris Isaak, his hit song, Wicked Game. Would you say this is something that kind of shows us that distinction?
That's a very good example, in fact. So sounds related to sadness will have a quieter voice, slower, lower in pitch, more of a kind of monotone where you don't move the pitch very much. There's quite a bit of mumbled speech that happens in a darker timbre.
And that's what we're hearing right now is this. And then when he sort of moves into his upper register and gets a bit more active as a singer, that's more of the grief part. Chris Isaak's Wicked Game. So, David Huron, as you were sort of talking about the song, we were hearing that sort of the verse, which is very softly sung and almost monochromatic, and as we're hearing again in the background, and then the chorus, it's like breaks into this kind of emoting. So that's the distinction between sadness and grief.
Yeah, you
in a 60-second clip.
In most clearly in the case of what we call breaking voice. So when he goes, no, it goes up high into the falsetto.
Oh, come on, David, sell it to me.
Okay, so if I were to really try to give you a crying voice, I'd start speaking sort of this sort of sound. Mm-hmm. And what's literally going on here is that you're breaking you're alternating between what we call modal voice, which is the normal speaking voice, and falsetto voice. And actually, this is the reason why the allergy plays an important role. When you have an allergy, you end up with that what we call a lump in your throat.
Right.
And what that actually is a constricted pharynx. And when the pharynx constricts like that, it makes the vocal cords very unstable. And as a consequence, you alternate back and forth between these two different. And what he's doing in that piece is he's making those little cry breaks, those little switches between modal and falsetto voice, and it just hits you right in the stomach. You, as a listener, you know exactly what that means. That's grief.
Yeah, and you know it. I mean, you've just explained it, but I think we sort of knew it on a sort of gut level. And there's the science of it from David Huron, who's on the line with us from California. Joining me in the studio is Amanda Stern. She's an author and host of the Happy Ending Music and Reading Series at Joe's Pub here in New York. Happy Ending. What are you doing here, Amanda?
Well, I'm here to talk about all my crying I do.
Are you one of those people who actively seeks out music that will make you kind of teary and misty-eyed?
I am. I guess I'm very allergic. I do. I seek it out, but for the purpose of actual release. I'm not masochistic in that way.
Well, what David was, you know, telling us the old joke, why do you keep hitting your head against the wall? Because
exactly.
It feels so good. Is that basically what?
In almost. It does feel so good when you're finished, but when you're banging your head against the wall, you're not processing anything, you're not moving through anything. If I'm listening to a sad song in order to cry, at the end of it, I've released something. I'm resolved. I've processed, for lack of a better word. So I feel emotionally more healthy by the end of it.
And does that impact your writing?
Well, I actually, when I'm writing, I need to be stuck inside of an emotion. So it's almost the opposite. I need to play music in order to become trapped inside an emotion I need to write about. So I need to be depressed.
So, but finishing, when you finish listening to that sad music and you've had a good cry, there is this feeling of what? Catharsis? Of having...
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, you walk around in the world sometimes with trapped grief.
Right.
And you, like David was saying, it's really, it's difficult to live with discomfort. I don't like it. And I also don't like to avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
I need to feel it in order to let it go. So that's what I do.
David, does that you know, does that sort of make sense to you as you've been studying this phenomenon?
Yeah, absolutely. The experience that Amanda describes is absolutely consistent with the research. The thing about all emotions is that every emotion serves a purpose. And sadness, and here I'd make an important distinction between sadness and depression.
Mm-hmm.
So depression is when the system is broken and there's a pathology there, and anyone who's depressed needs to go and get some help. But there is ordinary sort of basic B-flat sadness that occurs in the world. And let me give you an example. So I see a beautiful woman and I ask her out for a date, and she says, "No, get lost, you're an old geezer." And I see another beautiful woman and I ask her out for a date, and she says, "No, get lost, you're losing your hair." I see another woman, and she spurns my advances as well. At this point, I might start feeling sad. And what's likely to happen is that I'll start ruminating. And this is what we know happens with sadness, is people start thinking sad thoughts. Now, these aren't just sad thoughts. They're useful. So I might think, well, gee, I'm not such a handsome guy, and I've got my foibles. And now I start thinking maybe Jane. You know, Jane is maybe a bit plain-looking and so on, but there are many, many fine qualities to Jane. I wonder what would happen if I asked Jane out for a date. So notice what's happening here is that having experienced the world in a way that's not conducive to what my desires would be, I now start reorienting and adapting to my actual circumstance. And sadness plays a really important role in that adaptation process. So even just what we know is that people ordinarily look at the world through rose-tinted lenses, and so we're overly optimistic, and that's probably a good thing. But what happens when we get sad, believe it or not, you might think that we exchange the rose-tinted lenses for blue-tinted lenses and start thinking, oh, I'm a schmuck, I'm no good, and so on. But in fact, the research shows that when we're sad, that's when we're our most deadly realistic in our self-appraisals. So it actually serves a very important function.
Okay. Listeners, what do you think? What songs make you cry? Do you enjoy having a good cry, you know, occasioned by a song or a piece of music, orchestral music, or a jazz recording, or a bit of world music, whatever it might be? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or leave a comment on our website at wnyc.org/soundcheck. Two different listeners already told us on Facebook that the Canadian singer-songwriter Gordon Lightfoot makes them cry with this song.
A movie queen to play the scene of bringing all the good things out in me. But for now, love, let's be real. I never thought I could act this way, and I've got to say that I just don't get it. I don't know where we went wrong, but the feeling's
That is Gordon Lightfoot. If You Could Read My Mind, two different listeners telling us on Facebook that this does it for them when they want to have a good cry. Listeners, what do you think? Our number, 212-433-9692, or leave your comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. In a moment, we'll continue our conversation about sad, sad songs with your calls and comments. And then, a live performance from the band known as The War on Drugs. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This was voted the saddest music ever written by BBC listeners in 2004. It's the Adagio for Strings by the American composer Samuel Barber, and it has undoubtedly brought many listeners to tears since it was premiered in 1938. You may have heard it in the movie Platoon, among many, many others. For many of us, that's a good thing. Music-induced weeping can, in fact, be pleasurable. And joining me again on the line is Professor David Huron from Ohio State University, from their Cognitive and Systematic Musicology Lab, and here in the studio, the writer Amanda Stern, who actually hosts the Happy Ending Music and Reading series. And Amanda, unbidden by us, has presented us with two different playlists, one of music that makes you cry, mm-hmm. and the other, music that makes you sad. And they're not the same.
No, they're definitely not the same. I'm sort of happy and vindicated and validated that David said earlier that there are two different types of songs, one that elicits grief and one that elicits sadness, and I very much relate to that. There are songs that will create a heaviness in me, but I won't feel grief, I won't cry, and then others that I put on. If I need to cry, I know exactly, I curate my tears based on the selection of sad music I have.
So if we play a little bit of American Music Club, are the waterworks going to start here?
Well, if you play the chorus, you might have to lower the microphone to the floor.
This is from Amanda's playlist of songs that do make her cry. It's Mark Eitzel, the American Music Club, with The Decibels and the Little Pills. American Music Club, a.k.a. Mark Eitzel, and The Decibels and the Little Pills from his album Golden Age. That's on Amanda's list of her playlist of songs that makes her cry. There's also the playlist of songs that makes her sad, and you can find both of them on our Facebook page at facebook.com/WNYC_soundcheck. And I should mention Amanda's here prepared with box of tissues at the ready. Let's see what some of our listeners respond to musically. Allison's on the line with us right here in Manhattan. Allison, what does it for you?
Hi. Actually, what you played coming in between the break, that already got me teary-eyed, by the way.
The Adagio for Strings.
Yes, and I'm sorry. I know I should know that. But strings get me, but mostly in like more contemporary rock type things, like Dixie Chicks, if I hear it and the strings come on, and then definitely harmonies, like, you know, the best harmony of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. I'm a little old, so that just gets me, wells up right away.
So for you, it's a kind of a richness in the texture, an orchestral sound in a rock song, three or four part harmony in a pop song.
Absolutely.
Huh.
And it just automatically rises up. I don't know.
Wow. David, anything in the research that would suggest that a kind of a grander palette of sound might give people this feeling more readily?
It's actually there in the word volume. The big knob on your stereo is called the volume control, but that's actually because the industry didn't want to use the word loudness. But the original use of the word volume, it was coined by a famous psychologist at Harvard named S.S. Stevens. And what he meant by volume was the size of the sound. And so more instruments, a larger spaciousness to the sound, that has a direct emotional impact. In fact, many people who join a board of directors for an orchestra, if they come from business, that one of the first things they do is they often look at all the violins and say, gee, you know, it's so expensive to have all those violin players. Can't we just have like four or five and maybe amplify them and so on? And of course, the reason why you have to have all those violins is precisely because it makes for a big, fat, voluminous sound, which has this incredible emotional impact.
And, you know, it's worth pointing out that that famous adagio for strings, which everybody gets all teary-eyed at in its orchestral form, was originally part of a string quartet. And in the string quartet, with just the four strings, it's a beautiful piece, but it's not quite doesn't quite have the emotional impact of the orchestral version. Let's go back to the phones. Jules is on the line with us from the West Village. Jules, your contribution to our discussion?
Well, I just want to mention a quote by Suzanne Langer, who was a philosopher who worked in the area of aesthetics. The quote is, "Music sounds the way feelings feel." And her work dealt with the relationship between feeling and form. In other words, the form of the work itself, whether it's music or art. And it's something I read back in the 60s in a book of hers called The Problem of Art. And it stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And I never stop thinking about it because I'm always looking for music to match the particular kind of feeling I have at the moment. I can go days playing the same record, and at other times I can't find anything to match the feeling that I'm having.
You've touched a nerve with Amanda. She's got the head is vigorously bobbing up and down here. You have a similar.
Yeah, I completely relate to that. You know, there's something about identifying with the music at hand, and you know, I will hold in my tears until I find the match. You know, it's like a donor program or something. So I completely relate to that.
All right, let's see what some of our listeners are leaving on the comments page. That means time to head into the control room and Joel Meyer.
John, we have a lot of listeners who are adding to Amanda's playlist on wnyc.org/soundcheck. SS from Queens mentions Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. SS writes, "I don't know why it brings tears to my eyes, but I become so emotional when I listen to it, especially live." John, I'd like to hear from some listeners that have found themselves crying in inappropriate situations, in a concert hall, maybe on the subway when you're listening to your iPod. Peter Kay asks a question that's kind of hard to answer. He writes, "Why do the blues work? The lyrics are typically dripping with self-pity, my baby left me, no one loves me, etc. Yet the songs are strangely compelling, even uplifting and fun. Why?" And John, someone who calls themselves the original Howard P. tweeted us this suggestion. It's Joe Strummer's cover of the Bob Marley track, Redemption Song.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs. Redemption.
Joe Strummer. The late Joe Strummer and his recording of Redemption Song, the Bob Marley classic. Now, there, you know, we were talking about big textures. There's a guy and a guitar, and boy, that is pretty damn effective stuff. We're talking about songs that will bring a tear to your eye, literally. Amanda Stern, the author and host of the Happy Ending Music and Reading Series at Joe's Pub here in New York, is with me in the studio. David Huron's on the line. He's author of Sweet Anticipation, Music and the Psychology of Expectation. And David, you heard that commenter talking about the blues and asking, why would that work as a form, these really self-pityingly sad, kind of over-the-top morose lyrics, and yet, as the commenter said, it's kind of an uplifting feeling to listen to that.
I think that authenticity plays a big role here. Whenever we're emotionally touched, there's a kind of radar that comes up and says, but is this the real thing? So, you know, if you encounter somebody who's panhandling or something, you might be very sympathetic and empathetic, but there's this other part of you that's sort of worried about being taken advantage of.
And with all strong emotions, there is this what we call a cognitive overlay of trying to determine whether it's an authentic expression of the emotion. So a lot of the things that we find in music are sort of talismans of authenticity. You hear it in the sort of the gruffness of the voice, or you know, the intimacy of the sound, and so on. There's a feeling that I'm not, the wool isn't being pulled over my eyes. This isn't high production values. That's somebody's just trying to tug in my heartstrings. That plays an important role.
And in terms of something else that that Joel said in talking about the comments, Amanda, have you ever found yourself listening to one of your songs that makes you cry in an inappropriate place, you know, in a public place, on the subway
or something? Yeah, I actually often am put in a very strange position because I host this music and literary show. And Mark Eitzel, actually, who, of American Music Club, does have this song that makes me cry, that we played a little bit of, but that was not the version. So it's almost like you have to play the right version in order to get me. Mm-hmm. He sang it, and it was very difficult for me to hold back. I was really choked up. I've gotten choked up so many times in my own show.
And you have to get up on and stage and host.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's inappropriate.
Well, only because the name of the series is Happy Endings.
Exactly.
Ashish is joining us on the line from New Jersey. Ashish, give us an example of music that'll bring a tear to your eye.
Hi, I'm calling from New Jersey, and I'm originally of Indian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole generation, actually several generations of South Asians that have grown up with this music and a style of poetry called ghazals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's spelled Ghazals. And it's sung very simply with a very simple music arrangement, which specifically involves some of the sad instruments like sarangi.
Right.
Which have a long, whining noise.
Kind of a little cello instrument, yeah.
Absolutely. And the whole purpose of these songs and poetry is to evoke sadness. They don't necessarily make me cry, but they evoke incredible sadness. And when I listen to these songs, I know, oh, my God, this is how I feel. And I can't believe somebody wrote about it. And that is true for millions of people in South Asia. And it's true because millions of copies of these songs and albums are sold. And
well, that's Ashish, you're raising a couple of good points here. And I want to ask David really quickly. I mean, David, the South Asian ghazal tradition is centuries old. And even to those of us who do not understand Urdu or Hindi, you know, we can sort of understand that this is very emotional, but how much of this really is specific to understanding the cultural context, the lyrics, etc.?
So cultural context definitely plays a big role, but there are really two issues here. There are cross-cultural universals, like many of the factors that in crying, for example, the breaking voice and so on. All over the world, people understand what breaking voice means.
Right.
They hear that pharyngealized voice, what we call pharyngealized voice, that constriction, and they immediately understand the grief there. But there are quite large differences in terms of understanding what people would call sad music. So, for example, many Americans would listen to North Indian music, and they'd say, oh, that's very sad. But then the North Indians will say, no, that's not sad music, that's devotional music.
Right.
Or even within the United States, you'll find, for example, in the case of New Age music, some people think of the New Age music as sounding very sad, but other people will say, no, it's not sad, it's relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things that we found, is that whether you perceive the music as sounding sad or not depends on personality.
Well, you can see that reflected in the comments that are on our webpage, and I would urge you, if you're interested in the idea of music and the kind of emotional response, to check out the comments that have come in at wnyc.org/soundcheck. We've been speaking with David Huron on the phone, author of Sweet Anticipation, Music and the Psychology of Expectation. He's head of Ohio State's Cognitive and Systematic Musicology Lab. And Amanda Stern, author and host of the Happy Ending Music and Reading Series, which takes place tonight at Joe's Pub here in New York at 7 o'clock. Amanda, David, thank you both so much for being with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
Here's Etta James.
once cry.
Up next, the War on Drugs made their TV debut with Jimmy Fallon last night. Today, they're here with us in the Soundcheck studio. They'll play live in a moment.
I could do was cry.